this is Josh McAdams, the host of Pearlcast, with another Pearlcast interview. On October 26, 2005, I had the chance to interview Randall Schwartz, a key figure in the Pearl community. In the interview, we talked about Randall's books, business, and a few Pearlisms that can be attributed to him. Today on Pearlcast, I'm speaking with Randall Schwartz. Randall is the author of many Pearl books, including Programming Pearl, Learning Pearl on Win32 Systems, Learning Pearl Objects, References, and Modules, Effective Pearl Programming, Writing Better Programs with Pearl, Object-Oriented Pearl, and Pearls of Wisdom. Beyond that, he is also the owner of Stonehenge Consulting and frequently shows up at conferences and Pearl haunts on the web. Welcome to Pearlcast, Randall.
Hi, good to be here, Josh. Thanks for having me.
Just from that intro, you seem to be an amazingly busy man. Just getting this interview together, I've had a tough time catching up with you between our two schedules, so I'm glad you found the time to talk to me, and I'm sure all the listeners Learning Pearl. Why did you choose to update this book?
Learning Pearl 4th edition is not a huge change over the 3rd edition. The biggest problem with the 3rd edition, which was a complete rewrite over the 2nd edition, is that the 3rd edition came out before the Alpaca book. And the unfortunate part about that is that it didn't refer to the Alpaca book in any way, shape, or form. So when someone was finished with Learning Pearl 3rd edition, they went, oh, that's great. I now know a bunch of stuff about Pearl, and now I'm just going to have to dig into that old Camel book, or maybe attack the Pearl Cookbook, or at the time attack Advanced Pearl Programming 1st edition, which was way out of date, or maybe study those old Scary Man pages or stuff. But, you know, so there wasn't really any reference. And even though the Alpaca book came out, I think, about a year and a half later, we hadn't updated the Learning Pearl book to refer to the Alpaca book. Of course, we referred to the two books are actually images of our courses that we teach. We teach a week-long course that's based on the Llama book and a week-long course based on the Alpaca book. And, of course, our courses referred to each other because we wrote both of them. We just didn't have any references to that Llama book. So when Brian came along and joined the company as a full partner, one of the things he said was, you know, this really ought to get more aligned. We ought to have the books point at each other and make a lot more sense out of it. And I agreed with him. So he kicked me in the tail a little bit, got the project up on the schedule for O'Reilly, and shepherded the project to rewrite enough of Learning Pearl 3 to become Learning Pearl 4. And we're currently in the midst of rewriting the Alpaca to become Alpaca 2, which will have some of the things we sort of left out of the first edition, and also some forward back references, kind of a little cleanup, a little reassignment of where things go in terms of beginning versus advanced.
In case somebody's not familiar with the Alpaca and the Llama and things like that, the Alpaca is Programming Pearl and Learning Pearl is the Llama, or did I get that messed up?
No. Learning Pearl is the Llama. The Alpaca is Learning Pearl Objects, References, and Modules. Neither of them are the Camel book, Programming Pearl, which I created originally with Larry's help, and then I shepherded the second edition, and I was pulled off the third edition to focus entirely on the training side of the books.
When you were talking about the we there, you said you and Brian, and you're talking about Brian DeFoy.
Brian Foy. Sorry, don't pronounce the D or you'll get in trouble with him. Yes, Brian Foy. Brian's a new partner. Brian's actually been working with me for a number of years, and I've been with Brian even before that, before he was working for me. I was working with him as co-founders of the Pearl Monks organization. The original board of directors of Pearl Monks was me and Brian and Dave and one of Brian's co-workers. So I've been involved with Brian for a really long time, and I was really happy to bring him on as an instructor, and then made him a full partner in Stonehenge this year.
You mentioned also that you had co-authored the update, the 4th version of Learning Pearl, and you've also written a book with Tom Phoenix. So with all this dynamics of working together, I know you're on the East Coast, Brian's here in Chicago, I'm not sure where's Tom's at. How did it go updating this book?
Now, wait a second. You said I'm on the East Coast. I'm on the West Coast. I'm actually in the same city as Tom, but I only see him at conferences, believe it or not. We spend a lot of time online and email talking back and forth with each other, but I'm actually, because of my travel schedule, I'm pretty much around the world a lot, so I only see Tom when I actually have a scheduled conference to work together with, even though he's just down the street in my same city. But we have essentially a virtual corporation, so I have office staff in Portland, where I live, and occasionally I'm home. I happen to be home right now. Tom's also in the same city. In terms of collaboration, I mean, the whole purpose of the internet was to let people collaborate on things and communicate, and so we're pretty good at that, too. We write the books and book sections in pod, and we ship stuff back and forth, and we use a centralized change control system so that we can keep track of each other's writing, and we have one senior person for each book, that's usually me, to go through and kind of make sure that ultimately everything is all seamless and makes sense from an editorial standpoint before O'Reilly even gets to look at it, and It works out pretty well, actually. It's just a matter of recognizing that you don't have to be face-to-face with people to get things to happen.
Shifting gears a little bit, there are a handful of Pearlisms that can be contributed to you, and one that stands out is the Just Another Pearl Hacker Signatures. Could you give us a little history on that?
Yeah, I've been around Usenet since the real early days. 1981, I think, was one of my first posts. In fact, if you go to Google's history of Usenet, I'm actually referred to there because I'm talking about the upcoming Star Wars movies. So I've been around Usenet for a really, really long time. And somewhere around probably 5 years into that, I started signing my posts with Randall and something in quotes, some cute phrase in quotes, Schwartz. And the cute phrase would apply to whatever the news group was. Like it was a group on roller skating, Randall Skateaholic Schwartz or something like that. The signature was mostly the same, except it was tailored to the specific group. When I finally put most of that information about me and how to get a hold of me down into my signature block, the four lines after the double dash space, I would just sign above it then just another whatever hacker, depending on the group that I was posting in. For example, if it was in the shell group, I would say just another shell hacker. If it was in C, I would say just another C hacker, and so on. Just to kind of, you know, say as a way of sort of personalizing in the same way that I had done with my double-quoted message in between my name. When I got to the Pearl group, of course, as I started posting more and more messages to the Pearl group, every one of them was just another Pearl hacker, just another Pearl hacker, just another Pearl hacker, and it got really boring to keep typing exactly the same phrases. So one day I decided to get a little cute and say print quote just another Pearl hacker quote, and that started the whole sequence, because I think the next day then I said, well, I can't duplicate that again, so I did something with the word reverse, I believe it was, where I printed the string in reverse, and then I just started getting it more and more and more complicated, always trying to keep it in one line but not always succeeding. A few of my better ones are multiple lines, and just got it more and more obfuscated, and this became sort of a way that I represented myself, a way I distinguished myself on the news group. Very interesting when I started, you know, working with Larry on the first Programming Pearl Camel book, and because it identified me as being, you know, not just the guy that was there, but somebody who actually could play around with Pearl in a nice set of ways. And then that sort of got adopted by a few other people as being another sort of level of challenge. Like, okay, they wanted to come up with something that was sort of obfuscated and weird, and so they decided that the moniker Just Another Pearl Hacker sort of applied to the entire community, not just me, but I'm Just Another Pearl Hacker number zero, as I like to call myself, because I started the whole trend.
One thing you did mention was that you've been on Usenet since 1981, and one of my listeners pointed out a post that you had put on one Usenet group, and it was about audio versions of Pearl. And let's see, it was, I wouldn't want someone driving beside me listening to a tape about Pearl, even myself, and flipping down to look at graphics, because you thought that only Pearl audio would be useful if it had side aids. So what do you think about Pearlcast?
Well, that, I actually like what you've done with it, because I think what you're doing is making it more personable than just simply being an instruction book on Pearl. I don't think if I read Learning Pearl into a tape recorder that, well, that's such an archaic term, isn't it? But you know what I mean. It's like saying somebody has a record of something, you know, it's now a CD or whatever. But anyway, if I were to read the contents of Learning Pearl into an audio-only recording, it would be very useless. But what you're doing with Pearlcast is you're talking to people about things that they're doing, and I think that really works. I think I've listened to all your previous casts up to this point, and I like what you're doing. I like that. I'm actually honored to be you know, a member of this elite club now. It's very good, because you're not teaching Pearl. You're actually talking about what's happening, and what's happening doesn't require a lot of graphics.
Another one of the Pearlisms that you're responsible for, or at least is named after you, is the Schwartzian Transform. And so what is that, and how did that become named after you?
Oh, boy. Again, a lot of my life is, and in fact, I think they're going to put this on my tombstone, on my grave, is ruled by serendipity. You know, serendipity strikes again would be sort of my take on things. And that is that I end up with a lot of things that accidentally turn out to be really cool. And it seems like I almost count on that from time to time, but that seems to be the way it went. And the Schwartzian Transform was an example of that kind of serendipity. When I was starting my first phase of teaching and really sort of rolling out instruction in the on the corporate world, one of the things I would do was, of course, every break I would have, I would go log on to Usenet and see if there were any new postings that needed questions answered and things like that. And Unfortunately, my breaks were always fairly short because the breaks, priority one is being with the customer, being with the client. But, you know, I'd always tell them, okay, I may be up here looking like, you know, I'm doing a corporate hostile takeover or something, but really all I'm doing is answering my email and checking up on Usenet. So feel free to interrupt me. But anyway, so I'm reading through the different questions that had shown up in the day. And one of the questions that showed up in this particular day, and you can go to the Google News and see the actual posting that triggered this, was why is sort so slow? I think that was the subject line. And what they had done in this particular sort, they were sorting the password file, if I recall, and they were sorting based on the GCOS field, the real name field. And in the sort subroutine, there was this split that was taking the entire text line and breaking it into its seven component pieces by splitting on colon. As I stared at this problem, I knew exactly what was happening. I knew exactly what was going wrong because it's a kind of thing that I'd already described within our courseware as being something you really don't want to do. You want to keep the sort subroutine down to something that's very, very easy to compute because the number of times it will be invoked is n log n as you get more items. So it's going to be more and more expensive exponentially. Well, not quite exponentially. Somebody's going to write in and say, that's not right, Randall. But you know what I mean. It's going to get more and more as it gets more and more.
Close enough.
And
yeah.
That's not a good deal. Right. So I said, you know, this is just not going to scale well. And he was talking about having maybe 300 or 400 entries in his password file. And I went, oh, that is just going to be amazingly slow. Now, I'm an old Lisp hacker of all things. I've done a lot of work in Lisp and almost every language under the sun eventually. But one of the things that you do when you're programming in Lisp, it seems to happen really frequently, is you end up with, like, pipelining things. You end up taking one data structure and then mapping it through the Lisp concatenator things in Lisp to create another data structure, then concatenate that into a third data structure, and so on. So what I realized had happened was that I needed to somehow cache the results of that split and associate that with the original item, then sort based on that cached value, and then extract the original item back. And in a period of about 4 or 5 minutes, I sat there and worked through the steps. I mean, this was a quick thing. Remember, I'm just on a break in my class. I'm just trying to get back to class. I quickly said, here, try this, and I coded up what was basically the first use of the Schwarzian transform in public. And it was nothing unusual for me. It was just putting together building blocks and relying on some old techniques that I'd seen in Emacs Lisp before that. But it was just something that had to get done, and I didn't provide any explanation. Well, it's interesting that I hadn't provided any explanation because when I came back a few hours later, the next time I had a chance to get online, Tom Christensen had seen my post and essentially scolded me for not providing an explanation and also pointed out the small bug I had in my code. I forgot to add the new line back on the strings. And went through step-by-step elaboration, first explaining why this first thing was slow, then improving it one step after another through about step 6 or 7 or so, it's getting closer and closer to what I had done. Finally, he gets to step 7 or 8 or whatever it is that was exactly what I did, and he introduces that particular step as, and now let's go back to this Schwarzian transform. He sort of meant it as sort of a generic term, meaning something that Randall had done in a posting. Now, he posted that message, put that out there on the net, and I thanked him for that, if I remember right. I posted a little thing, thanks for the extra explanation. The next week, somebody had a sorting question, again on Usenet, and somebody else followed up and said, oh, that's simple, you need to use a Schwarzian transform. And I chuckled at that, because that was supposed to be a generic term, just meaning something Randall did, but he was using it like it was a proper noun. And then that started catching on. Other people posted questions, other people had answers, and it said, use the Schwarzian transform. So it created a life of its own. It wasn't anything that I started. I don't even imagine that Tom was thinking that it was going to be the proper name for this sequence of map, sort, map to speed up the acceleration of sort. And I can tell that because in a following post, Tom even said something to that effect. I can't quote this exactly, but he said something to the effect of, well, you know, I really didn't mean Schwarzian transform to have all the magical, mystical qualities that people have been assigning to it, so I'm just going to call this the black transform. And there he was making fun of the fact that Schwarz in German is black, but of course that never took off. That never stuck. People continued to call it the Schwarzian transform and then ended up in the FAQ being that, and so I've got my bit of immortality that way. But for me, it was just a quick thing I'd done in 5 minutes. Didn't expect it to have a life of its own, but now I'm a part of the Perl culture as a result.
That's absolutely amazing.
It's a neat story.
But that's the way everything happens in the pearl culture. This is the amazing part of it. There are little bits of things being done by people all over the place in the pearl culture, and they create these little sort of pockets of things that just take a life of their own. I mean, the CPAN started as an idea of a few people coming together saying, we need something like this. You know, the whole pugs thing, you know, Autregis just all of a sudden going, boom, let's just make this thing work, and starting with one goal in mind and creating an entirely separate thing out of it, an entirely different relation. Pearl Monks started as an idea of one guy, Tim Vroom, said, let me have like a little bulletin board system that Pearl people can talk on. And they've become much larger than anybody ever imagined them to be. And I think the Pearl culture, while not being unique in this sort of taking a seed and making it grow, I think it's continually been the reason that Pearl has expanded into all the areas that it's expanded into, because there is this encouragement to kind of put something out there, even if it isn't quite right, even if it's not quite fully formed, or even if you don't think it's all that useful, at least have a place to register it on Pearl Monks or put it in the CPAN or something and let other people poke at it and see if there's something useful to it. I imagine that when Andy Wardley created Template Toolkit, he was just solving his little problem in the corner. Now it's become the sort of the granddaddy de facto standard template toolkitting system, you know, templating system that everybody seems to use for a lot of different projects. It just seems to be that way in the Pearl culture. There have been a lot of very interesting individual contributions that have all together created a great synergy to where we have, you know, this huge, you know, how many thousands of modules on the CPAN and all these downloadable scripts. And, you know, I could even argue that Pearl revolutionized and made way for the web. You know, without Pearl, I don't imagine we'd be seeing WWW on the sides of buses quite yet. You know, I think this all had an impact as well. And again, that was just, again, the marriage of the right things. Tim Berners-Lee came along, said, I want to have, you know, hyperlinked documents. And the Pearl guy said, oh, by the way, we can move data into there. We can manage the log files. We can create interactivity with Pearl. And it was a marriage made in heaven. So it's the same sort of synergy. It just keeps working. Open source is there. Individual contributors are there. Lots of cooperation is there. And yeah, you know, there's hitches with it, but I think overall, I think we've gotten here because we have this wonderful cooperation, this wonderful sort of opportunity with Pearl.
So is it the community? Is it the language? What is it? Why did you end up choosing Pearl in the beginning and sticking with it so long?
I got into Pearl because it was solving my problems. I saw Pearl 1. Downloaded it off the net. I was using mostly a bad mix of sed and awk and grep in my shell scripts. And this is back in the early days. So I'd say, Pearl 1 was 1977. So probably, 1987. I've been using Unix since 1977. So by the time 87 rolled around, I was already pretty fluent in sed and awk and grep and shell and M4. I've written entire project management systems in M4, for example. You don't want to go there, you know. But so I got fluent in a lot of different things. And when I saw Pearl 1 come along, the only thing that first attracted me to it was by Larry Wall. And I had been using the RN newsreader as my primary newsreader for a number of years, and I was impressed because the RN man pages were something like 30 or 40 pages long. And I thought, anybody who can put together a free piece of software that has a man page that's 30 pages long and then just give it away, and it does such cool stuff and it just seems to work right. I think the best phrase in the RN man page is, it may not be any faster, but it seems faster. You have to go dig up the old man page to find out the reference, what that actually is about. But I love that phrase. It so describes Larry's philosophy. It just works. It works amazingly well. So here comes Pearl 1, comes along, looks like it can replace some of my awk programs, but it just didn't quite have the flavor that would really sink in for me. But I downloaded and played with it for a little while. Pearl 2 comes along, and it had like twice the size of the man pages. And I went, oh, this is interesting now. And I started writing different things in Pearl, and I went, oh, this is simpler in Pearl than it is in that complicated 8-process launching thing that I had before. And then I went on to the Unix newsgroups, the Unix Questions and Unix Wizards newsgroups, and I started answering the questions that they had in Pearl. And it's funny because after a while, I started doing it for like 3 or 4 months. I was like, here's somebody had a question, and I could do it in 1 or 2 lines of Pearl. Somebody else had a question, I could do it in 4 or 5 lines of Pearl. I started realizing how powerful Pearl was, that almost everything people wanted to do that would have been a 10 or 15 line shell script could be done in a 1 or 2 line Pearl program. In fact, I answered that so many times in the Unix shell and the Unix Wizards news groups that there started to be people that would post a question and immediately post below that, no Pearl, please. because I had done it so often that they now thought there was going to be me popping up there again posting a Perl answer. So I would respond to those by first posting the 8 or 10 lines of shell script it took to solve their problem, and then the 2 lines of Perl. So again, just to show them that. So I really was one of the first champions of the Perl sort of, it just works. But I was only looking at that from the point of view of being a user. I was an excited user. It got me to do the things I wanted to do. And I was really happy that Larry was, you know, spitting this code out from this mythical location of the Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena. He was spitting this stuff out, and I was able to magically use it and do what I wanted to do. Then when Perl 3 came along, Larry asked for anybody that could be involved as alpha testers. You know, people who had an opportunity to download some of the early versions of the code and provide him feedback. And it was kind of like the early version of P5P, because we were supposed to give feedback. We were supposed to try to compiling it on machines he didn't have and just kind of expand it out. And that was really great because I got to play with an early version. And Perl 3 had like, you know, 3 or 4 times the size of the man page. The man page had gone from like 15 or 20 pages up to about 60 pages, if I can recall correctly. The thing was, it was a much larger language, much richer. It had binary data. It had the ability to talk TCP/IP and pull stuff out into separate modules and things. It was very separate included files. I really liked it. It really was like getting close to being like, well, let me just ditch C and use this for everything, for everything I was going to do low-level stuff with. And something interesting happened when that Perl 3 was finally released out to the net. There was a complaint that although the man page was nice for Perl 3, the language had become significantly harder. So, Larry, please, won't you write a book on the style of Introduction to Sed and Awk from O'Reilly that sort of covered the intro to Perl so that people could understand where the small end of the language is? You know, where do we really start in this 60-page man page? So Larry said, in his very kind and gentle way, his normal sort of response was, well, when I get around to it, I'll write something up. Well, I had known from conversing with Larry in email that Larry's getting around to it meant when he's not dealing with his wife and his 4 kids and the church choir and his day job, and I'm told he sleeps from time to time, so you subtract that out of 168-hour week, and there's not much time left. So I volunteered, with my technical writing background, I volunteered to help Larry with the online documentation. Somebody at O'Reilly & Associates saw that message, replied back to me privately, and said, look, Randall, if you're going to write a book, we might as well publish it. And so after a couple of rounds of conversation with O'Reilly, I then said, you know, the only way I want to make this book happen is to bring Larry on as well, because it'll add more credibility, and I'm going to be involving Larry on a lot of the questions anyway. So I wrote Larry and invited him into the project, and I designed the book with Larry's assistance. I managed the project through there, and that became the first Camel book 9 months later. Now, having written the Camel book, the first authoritative book on Perl, I was thrust into the center of the Perl community, not just being a cheerleader over on the side saying, come use Perl as a happy user. I was now like one of the chief writers about Perl, and I'm still, to this day, I've written, you know, all those books that you listed and over 270 magazine articles, which you didn't mention at all. So my byline has been out there 22 million times so far. You know, it's because Perl works for me, and I want to talk about it, and I want to have other people use it. I'm not a zealot, though. I'm still like, use the best thing for the best language. But God, if I can help you use Perl to use it, then that'll be my way. So I'm very prolific. I'm online 2 hours a day answering email and talking on Perl Monks and talking on IRC, trying to get everybody get questions answered and designing the next courseware that I'm going to be teaching and designing the next book I'm going to be writing and figuring out what magazine article I'm going to write this month. Okay. That was all in one breath, by the way.
That was good.
Yeah.
Scared to ask the next one. No.
Yeah. Okay.
No. I didn't realize 270 magazine articles. I did see that on Perl Monks you had over 5,400 posts. And one listener wrote back and said you actually have more books than you do modules on CPAN. I was going to ask why, because it's backwards to how a lot of coders are. A lot of times you see a lot of code and very little writing, and instead you have a whole lot of writing to explain how to use all of the code. And you mentioned a technical writing background. Would you care to talk a little about that?
the primary reason I don't have very much on the CPAN is generally I'm not spending a lot of time these days working for real contract clients. So most of my work these days is writing and teaching and kind of staying in that arena and managing my company, where I have people that I send out to do contracting and actual code work and getting down and dirty. Most of the code that I've written has been because it's now the end of the month and I've gotten the second letter from my editor for the monthly article that's now a week past due. And when I do that kind of an article where I now have to come up with an idea, come up with some code that supports it, write the code, write it up as a module, that kind of thing, and then put that as part of my article, the problem with that is that that code belongs to the magazine now. So I can't just easily take that code and put that on the CPAN separately because I have written the code as part of what I'm being paid for to write the magazine article. I have an agreement to take all of my magazine articles and put them all back on my website, www.stonehenge.com, but only sort of intact. I can't then do something further with those articles. The copyright still belongs to the original magazine. And because I write the magazine article first and the code sort of falls out of that, I can't just take that code and put it in the CPAN. I can't even just take that code and give it to somebody else. I've had people write me and say, can I use the code from this article? And I say, I can't actually tell you yes. You will have to talk to the magazine. I can't tell you yes because I don't own that copyright. Now, the few things that are in the CPAN are things where slightly ahead of the pressure of writing the monthly magazine article, I actually come up with an idea. And then I sit down and I code the idea and I play with it a bit and work it out and write up some doc for it. Or maybe I'm doing this for a client that's let me put it in the CPAN like CGI Prototype is. So I've got some headroom on it. I've actually written the code and gotten it into the CPAN. Now, when the end of the month comes along, I write a magazine article about the code that's already published. Ha! Now I've got something both in the CPAN and an article about it, and that's been wonderful and peachy keen when I can remember to do that. But that's the reason. I've written thousands and thousands of published lines of code. It's just that they're all inside the magazine articles, and unfortunately I cannot just lift those and put those into the CPAN. I'd really love to, but I can't by copyright reasons.
A lot of those articles you've written have been published recently, I say recently, within the last year in a book by APRES. Is that right?
Yeah, The Pearls of Wisdom was a selection of about, I think, somewhere between 60 and 70 of what my favorite 240 articles at the time had been. They went through and bought the rights from the other magazines, from the magazine publishers, so that they could republish them in a book form. So I don't even own those rights, so they had to go out and acquire the rights to do that. And then they consulted with me to say, you know, is this the best 60 out of those? And I said, well, you know, if you pick those two, you're really doing the same thing twice because the second one's just a better version of the first one. And so I was able to kind of guide them along, you know, and kind of tell them what articles I'd referred to the most and questions and answers I'd answered on the net. I mean, that's one thing. If you've gone through Pearl Monks a little bit, you might have noticed that about every sixth or seventh post, I say, well, I wrote an article about that. Because it is. I mean, why repeat something in an entire Pearl Monks post when I have an entirely detailed 2,000-word article that already describes the answer to one of their questions? And that's also an indication that I'm hitting the pulse really well on writing the articles because a lot of the questions people have get answered by my articles. Anyway, so the APRES went out, bought the rights to the articles, consulted with me. They originally wanted me to go through and edit all those articles to kind of bring them up to date. And I said, you know what? That will expand it from a good long weekend to 4 or 5 solid weeks of work. Because, you know, the problem with being a writer is that you can always go back a second time and go, oh, I should completely rearrange this and change to that and so on. I said, here's what I'll do instead for you. Let's leave the articles historically intact as they were originally published. So what you're reading in Pearls of Wisdom is the original article as it was shown originally. And what I've done is, in the case where I wrote an article saying this is the way something worked, but I wish there was a module that did this, and then later on somebody actually had a module that did it, I've put a sidebar in there that says, well, now if I wrote this today, it would be this module and that module, and the whole code would have been from 100 lines down to 20 lines, and here's how it would be. So I was able to put the sidebars in to really kind of bring some historical perspective to these articles. Also, some of the sidebars were about the process I used to write the article, like what was I thinking at the time, what was the problem I was solving at the time, or maybe things that happened after the article was published. For example, article. I have an article in there about scraping the Dilbert website to pick up the Dilbert Historical Archive so that in one page you can pull up all the Dilbert comics at once. And I talk about how the moment that that article was published, they changed the format. Coincidence? I don't know, but it's the only time the format's ever been changed in the entire history of that website. It was right after my article was published. So the old version that was in the magazine would no longer work. You had to change two URLs to make it work in the new article. So, you know, did they do that to keep my program from scraping it? I don't know. But that's my sidebar. I'll be able to say this in historical perspective now. And I really appreciate that A-Press let me do that, because it sort of said, okay, here's these great articles. People have been reading them. One of my reviewers said they're exactly the right length. And he tells me privately that that means, of course, they're right length for us sitting in the smallest room of your house. And so here's these articles that are great to read, nice and easy. Just go to the punch, get right to the point. And then I put a little bit of historical perspective with it by my little sidebars on most of the articles. And I think it's a great book. It's actually, I'm glad it's out there, because a lot of people, you know, they know my website has them all, but you know, you can't read my website on a train or a plane unless you have a good wireless access on either of those. And I'm glad A-Press did that for me. It's really nice of them.
And so all your articles, you have some in the in A-Press book, you have multiple magazines with articles, you have a lot of them reposted on your website, and also on Pearl Monks and I think IRC and things like that, you use the alias of Merlin, right? Is that how people would
I try to use Merlin everywhere I can. The places where I can't use Merlin, believe it or not, this started with AOL, of course. I tried to get the name Merlin on AOL, and it was taken by the time I got there. So, of course, I went, darn it, I'm the real Merlin. So I'm real Merlin on AOL, and I'm also real Merlin any place I can't get Merlin. So that's the only other handle I use. It's pretty rare to find me with some other alias than that.
Any significance behind choosing that one?
Yeah, in high school, I read the book The Crystal Cave and fell in love with the whole Merlin genre. And although when I say fall in love with it, I just sort of read that book and I kind of stopped reading about it. So it's a little weird, because I was fascinated by that particular aspect of it. And as I'm reading that book, they spell Merlin with a Y, and I kind of like that as a distinction. So when people spell it with an I, I say that's the Disney spelling. Mine is the other spelling, you know, the one with a Y. And that, again, is taken up by a lot of people as well. But it's also the reason that I use Stonehenge for my company name, though, because of this whole high school fascination I had with Merlin and the whole mystical thing of Stonehenge was selected because it was related to, in some literature, Stonehenge is called Merlin's Dance. It's the stones that Merlin set up. Of course, historically, that would be wrong because, you know, theoretically, Arthur's time was, you know, 2,000 years after Stonehenge was built. But, you know, a little bit of adjusting of time here and there, it's all good.
You mentioned Stonehenge Consulting, which is your company, and they advertise Pearl Training, Pearl Consulting, Guru On Demand Services. Could you tell us a little more about what you guys do?
Yeah, primarily over the last 10 years, we've been a boutique Pearl training company. By that I mean that we specialize almost exclusively in training Pearl. We do a little bit of other stuff too, but basically we do Pearl training because that was needed and wanted from 1995 to, you know, 2003 or so. There were some consulting gigs, some contracting gigs along there, but primarily we were training. Starting the last couple of years, the need for Pearl training has kind of subsided a little bit. I still think we've got probably 75% of the national market at this point, and some of the international market, but not so much. But we're also looking more and more at what other ways our skilled people can be used to provide high-level consulting services. For example, one of the things we've done with clients in the past is we'll go in for an entire week with one of our trainers/coders, and provide some large group trainings, like maybe for a day or two of that, some small group trainings, maybe one-on-three, one-on-one kind of trainings, and then some code review, some design review, and just kind of open Q&A sessions. So we basically go in and try to infuse the kind of high-level knowledge quickly so that instead of having to have an on-site Pearl guru. We're basically having a Pearl guru rented for a week, and we hope that through our osmosis process, that, you know, the immersion in the large group trainings and the sort of hands-on with the small group trainings, that we leave the organization much greater enriched. At least we eliminate probably 75% of their worst practices and give them a whole new set of best practices to work from, and that's been really successful. Our clients have reported really good results from that. So the guru on demand session is something kind of like that, and we can scale that down to a one-day show or a two-week show or whatever. We also have some longer term clients that we do basically on retainer consulting. So we have some clients that pay us money every month, and we guarantee a certain number of hours of consulting in response to that. And we've placed contractors for, you know, weeks or months at a time as well. So we're kind of, you know, whatever works. If it's about Pearl, we can probably either have somebody on staff, or we can find somebody real quickly to put that in. And, you know, and the trainings are still pretty happy and still keeping us pretty busy too. So that's kind of the scope of Stonehenge at this point.
From that, it sounded like it was more not like you would be handed some specs and code out a program in your closet and then hand it back to the company, but you're really there to share your knowledge and enrich their employees.
Yeah, we've done both of those. One of the advantages we have over, say, a traditional contractor or consulting house is that because our senior team are all trainers, we're also professional communicators, as you might have told from this conversation already. I like to talk, I suppose, is the easy way to say that. But what we know is we know how to talk about what we're doing. We know how to teach. We were trained to be up in front of a room or talk one-on-one about what we're actually getting across. And so unlike, say, someone who, well, let's call them the traditional nerd, the traditional geek, where they know their stuff, but they don't really know how to talk about their stuff, we know both how to do it and talk about it. So we leave a lot more behind than just, you know, 4,500 lines of code. We actually have 4,500 lines of code and a changed way of viewing the code instilled in every participant in our organization.
You also tend to show up at tons of Pearl-related events. We were talking earlier and you said you'd actually been to two Geek Cruises within the last 3 weeks.
You
go to just about every conference. So could you tell us a little bit about, I mean, are you there to speak? What are you there to do?
I go to conferences for a variety of reasons. At OSCON, I'm just sort of part of the woodwork now at this point. I try to get at least two or three talks accepted every year, although the competition is much more fierce the last couple of years. I try to get a tutorial accepted as well. I also have the exhibit booth at OSCON, and then of course there's the famous Stonehenge party that's there every year. But what I'm trying to do at the conferences is two-way. I want to both be there to be present so that people are reminded, hey, we're Stonehenge, we're over here, we've got services available for you. We're, you know, unlike some of our competitors, we're still in business. We're still kicking in tail there and being active participants in the Pearl community. But also, I want to go to conferences where Pearl's being discussed so that I know what's happening next. So I know what people are interested in, you know, so I know what magazine articles to write about. I know what books to write. I know what courseware needs to be generated. So, and to kind of converse on that level as well. Plus, you know, at a conference, there's a lot of networking that happens. I meet a lot of really fascinating people at conferences, and that's been really cool. It's actually, you know, it's where I met Brian. It's where I met all the people that work around me and for me. So it's a matter of, well, except some of those I haven't used, and I just realized that. But it's a place to network. It's a place to really kind of figure out what's going on. It's also a great place to recognize that you're not alone, that it's not just you downloading some piece of software and then using it, and maybe you see a couple websites about it, but that's it. When you go to a conference, even like Yapsi or like the Pearl World cruises and things, when you go to these things, you start realizing there are other people that are solving completely different things than you're solving, or maybe they're solving almost exactly what you're solving, the same sorts of problems. But you get to chat with them, and it gets to become more of a, okay, I'm part of a tribe. This is cool. I'm actually a member of something. It's not just me being somebody who's, you know, pushing ones and zeros around using this particular technology. It's actually like, okay, there are a lot of other people that are as crazy as I am about this stuff and want to keep using it. It's reinforcing. It helps me to sell it to my boss. It helps me to, you know, to understand where I can go if I have trouble. It helps me to know I'm not alone if I'm in, like, I have a concern or a question. And so I'm there, back to me again, I'm there at conferences so people know that I fully welcome people sending me email. I do. I enjoy email. I don't enjoy spam. I enjoy questions, though, about Pearl. I love getting those. I get maybe 20 a day. And it's great because not only do I get to make a difference specifically for the person that I get to answer the question for, but it's second, it lets me know. It gives me my finger on the pulse of where people are having problems, because that leads to my next magazine article, my next course, my next book, my next area of research, if a lot of people are working on something, that kind of thing. And so it's not completely altruistic. It's really great because it's really a two-way street. They help me by sending me questions. And I think that's a remarkable sort of synergy. It's amazing. It's why I spend an hour every day being on Pearl Monks and answering email and hitting Usenet as much as I can and so on. It gives me a place to contribute and be contributed to in a great sharing way.
conference season is winding down and you've been to quite a few. What is exciting that you see in the Pearl world? What's coming up that we need to be looking out for?
Until Pugs, I was worried about Pearl 6. You know, just being real honest with that. Pugs has reinvigorated an entire new community in trying to get Pearl 6 off the ground. And I know there's a lot to do. There's still a lot to be done to make Pearl 6 really work. But I'm excited by that. Of course, I'm terrified by Pearl 6, as you know, given that most of my business is about providing Pearl training and Pearl writing, because the moment Pearl 6 really becomes official, a lot of my stuff has to get rewritten, and it can't all be rewritten in the same day. But I'm excited as a user of Pearl. I mean, some of the stuff I'm seeing that people are doing with Pearl 6 and some of the design features I'm seeing in Pearl 6 are exciting me as much as that Pearl 3 did when I was using Pearl 2 and how Pearl 2 did when I was using the shell. It's like, here is something that's going to solve more of my problems in a simpler way. I can write fewer lines of code, and I've got more time at the end of the day to just sit around and surf the web and read Wikipedia until my fingers fall off. You know, it's a chance for me to get more effective at doing what I'm doing so that I don't have to think about doing what I'm doing as often as I can. So I love what Pugs is doing. I think that's very important. I like where CGI Prototype's going, CGI Prototype being my MVC platform, the very lightweight platform to do web applications. By bringing everything back to its core. I like that I have clients that are paying for me to make changes to that and yet letting me release it to the CPAN. This is really, really a cool synergy of things that are going on there. I like that GAPSEs are happening all over the world. This is exciting me. I can't go to all of them. I mean, you mentioned that I go to a lot of places, but I can't go to every GAPSE. There's too many of them now. You know, that's crazy. I love that there are more Pearl conferences than I can make it to. That's great. That is incredible. I love that there's a lot more Pearl books on the shelf than I can read. That is also very cool. That means that Pearl is alive and kicking. I love seeing jobs.pearl.org increase every month, the number of postings. Not only increase every month, but increase the dollar value, the average dollars of what they're willing to pay people, and jobs shifting from being Pearl plus 18 other things to being just full-time Pearl programmer, $80,000 a year, working for DreamWorks. That was just on there yesterday. That's amazing. Working for a movie production company doing Pearl full-time for $80,000 a year. Lovely stuff. This is great. I think Pearl is bigger than ever, and I'm still with it, and I'm going to stick with it probably as long as Larry does. And Larry says he's got a long way to go.
You mentioned CGI Prototype being one of the modules you're excited about. What about the heavier weight alternative? I think it's heavier, Catalyst. Have you paid any attention to that or noticed what those guys are doing?
When I first looked at Catalyst, when I was researching the playing field before I wrote CGI Prototype, one of the things I didn't like about Catalyst is that it made a lot of decisions for me about what a particular application looked like, and I didn't see the right hooks to kind of push it the way I wanted to push it. Same thing with Maypole. Catalyst actually came out of Maypole, but in CGI Application also, I looked at all three of those as being the most touted solutions for this kind of stuff. It seemed to me that the people that created those applications were solving the most common problems without having been able to step back and do a real systems thought and a systems design. In other words, what parts of all the applications on the web are the same, and what parts are different, and how do you spell the parts are the same once, and how are you able to completely and easily spell the parts that are different once? Catalyst and Maypole and CGI Application all let you write a narrow range of applications, but they don't have enough tweaks to completely include just about everything you'd want to do on the web. And so when I designed CGI Prototype, I said, let me go back to fundamental principles. What really happens on a web hit? And by abstracting it all the way back to the beginning, and then using a nice framework of a class prototype, so I'd essentially get accesses for free and subclasses for cheap and things like that, I was able to more rapidly develop applications using CGI Prototype than any other framework that I've worked in, including having spent some time trying to work with Catalyst and Maypole to make that work. I think it's because I stayed minimal. I just stayed with what are the basics. And that's given me the framework that I need, and it's been really, really useful. My customers have gotten a lot more leverage out of me than I would have had I tried to be tweaking Maypole and trying to dig into the details of it every time, Catalyst, and fixing the bugs that I saw in CGI Application. So I'm leveraged. And that's the whole point of having a good framework, is that I'm not spending my time thinking about the framework, except when I'm tweaking it to make something better. I'm spending time when the customer says, I need a new page that does this. I go, okay, there's the TT file, there's the PM file, we need these callbacks, there's the code that goes right there. We need this code reused from the other part of the application, great, include, 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 and it's done. I mean, the design is simple. You add a couple files and you're in the new state. It's just right there. It's like Ruby on Rails. In fact, somebody said I should come up with a more clever name than CGI Prototype. My current name I'm kicking around is Pearl on Planks. So we'll see. You know, I may be just retitling the whole project to that. And so you may see that come to the CPAN near you. We'll have a clever name like that. But I like where it's going. The people that have been playing with it, you know, Brian took it on for a client that we had. And, you know, at first he grimaced at it. He went, eh. But then he started playing with it. He goes, you know, he says, every time I try to do something, the right hook is there. And I go, yeah, that's because I sat back and thought about what hooks needed to be there. You know, it's not accidental. I've been programming for 32 years professionally, and I have a sense of where things need to go. You know, I've been around the web since the beginning. I have a sense of where things need to go in terms of design. And I also have a systematic sense. I look at the systems. I look at the large picture all the time. It's one of my downfalls, but it's, you know, keeps me out of the details, but it is what I'm doing all the time. And the clients that are taking it on, I mean, I love that I didn't have to create the mailing list or the SourceForge site for it. Somebody else wanted CGI Prototype so much that they just went out and created a FAQ for it. They created a mailing list. They created a SourceForge website. Somebody else is adding some of the features that I wanted in there. We're now editing stuff on SourceForge, working together as a team. And I don't have to do that, so I'm getting leverage for free. It's enough people like it already that it's becoming this sort of, you know, community building around it. And that's like one of these accidental things again. I needed a framework. I shared it with people, and now it's taken a life of its own. And the important thing is to not stand in its way, but to actually let that process happen, and things will result from that.
I've taken quite a bit of your time, and I know you're very busy, so I guess I'll wrap it up and not ask any more questions. Is there anything else you'd like to tell the audience?
Just, I appreciate this opportunity. I, like I said, I've been listening to your Pearlcast for a while, and I'm in... I feel like it's pretty cool that I get to hang out with some of the other people you've interviewed already, so this is really nice. I have fun. I like having fun. I like the classes that I teach to have fun. I like the writings that I have to have fun. I think it's probably ultimately the most important thing about me. And I think what I'm trying to do is also bring that level of energy and fun into the Perl community. I think people sort of report that. I get a bit short-tempered after, you know, answering the 37th post that was coming right out of the FAQ, like anybody else does. But I try to help people at the same time I'm having fun. I'm privileged to be needed enough to have to travel all around the world all the time, you know, to go talk to people about Perl and about programming in general and computer security and things like that. I appreciate all that. I'm living a life that I never could have imagined as a kid, and I love it. And I'm going to keep doing it for a long time. And, you know, it's for me, life's not about money. It's about having fun at the end of the day. So I'm not, don't think I'll ever be rich. I'm not getting rich off of anything I'm doing here. I'm trying to give back as much as I can. And I'm just glad to be a part of all this.
Well, I'm sure many people out in the Perl community appreciate it. Thank you very much, Randall.
Thank you very much, Josh. It's been really great talking to you. Thank you.
I'd like to once again thank Randall for the interview and hope that you enjoyed it as much as I did. The GarageBand.com artist that wrapped this interview was Siphon with their track Wasted. Thanks for listening, and be sure to stay tuned to Perlcast for more Perl audio.